Help yourself when they are not looking, Hohagen suggested. I'll take the blame. If they give me hell, I can just point to my head. He and Franz chuckled. Early the next morning, Franz and Hohagen snuck across the deserted, frost-covered field. Inside a hangar, they found a Kettenkraut fully fueled. Franz started the vehicle. Over the rattling engine, he reached out his hand. Hohagen shook it with vigor. Franz clunked the vehicle into gear and drove away. 6 days later, May 4th, 1945. Franz felt uncomfortably alone as he drove the Kettenkraut west along the narrow, winding road deep within the Alps. The road flowed through a mountain pass, alongside a stream of icy, pale blue water. Clumps of snow clung to the road's fringes, where pine trees stood creaking in the wind. Every now and then, an abandoned car or truck lay in a roadside ditch, the victim of winter driving. Franz stopped to siphon gas from the wreck's fuel tanks. Franz had entered the Alps near Hallein, Austria, several days earlier, and driven until he found a lodge where other wayward soldiers had congregated. Franz had joined them and lived off his canned food while waiting. On May 1st, he and the others crowded around a radio that announced the news they had long expected. Hitler was dead. He had shot himself in his bunker. A day later, Germany's forces began surrendering, first in Berlin, then in Italy, and finally, on May 4th, in Bavaria. Having decided it was safe to surrender, Franz had left the lodge and steered his Kettenkraut back onto the deserted road that led west to Berchtesgaden, where the Americans were rumored to be. The Kettenkraut sputtered. Its six-tracked wheels ground slowly to a halt. Franz turned to the side of the road and stepped out. A glimpse of the gas gauge confirmed he was out of fuel. He lit a cigarette and grabbed his backpack. He pulled his black logbook from the pack and dropped it into the deep thigh pocket of his leather flying pants. The book was a prized possession of his that documented his 487 combat flights. He removed his holstered pistol from his belt and tossed it into the back of the Kettenkraut. It could only get him in trouble. Leaving the pistol and empty backpack behind, Franz began walking west in his heavy boots. Franz looked for road signs to Berchtesgaden, but someone had torn them down. He chain-smoked. Whenever the pines creaked, he stopped, looked, then resumed his trek. The party's propaganda had told him the Americans would be vengeful, and after they had worked a prisoner over, they would hand him to the French or Soviets for further punishment. Franz hoped this was not true. After his experience in the desert, he would have preferred to be a prisoner of the British. Franz passed through a tiny hamlet of a half-dozen homes on either side of the swift-flowing stream. There, along the side of the road, he stopped and looked up. Hanging from a telephone pole was a dead German soldier in a gray army uniform. Franz looked back the way he had come from and thought, maybe this was not so smart. He shook the idea from his mind. The Americans had not done this. They wanted the Germans to surrender, not to run away and keep fighting. Franz continued. A half a mile later, he came to a split in the road. To his right, the concrete road continued through the mountain pass. To his left, a small wooden bridge led across the stream to a dirt logging road. The logging road hugged the mountainside and was dark with shadows. Franz decided to take the logging road because it was more likely to be deserted. Franz set out again, his boots now crunching the dirt. Through gaps in the pine trees, he kept his eyes on the bright, flowing stream and the main road beyond the stream, where he expected to see American tanks. Turning a bend, Franz stopped in his tracks. In the path ahead of him stood 20 or more SS soldiers. He instantly recognized them by their camouflage smocks with light green and brown spots. Some were digging in. Others were setting up machine guns over fallen trees and aiming their rifles across the stream toward the main road. A few sat on rocks along the mountainside, smoking and cradling machine pistols. Franz realized they had hung the soldier he had found earlier. It was a message to other Germans to stay away. They had most likely mined the main road and were waiting for the same American tanks Franz had expected to see. "Now you've done it," Franz thought to himself, cursing his decision to take the logging road. Franz resumed his stride toward the SS soldiers. He knew he could not turn back, having discovered their ambush. He hoped he could give the impression of complete disinterest and walk through them like a passerby. He reached his hand into his right pocket and grabbed his rosary. His fingers had long stripped the black paint from the beads, completing their transformation to a pale purple color. As he passed the first soldiers, Franz tried not to look at the silver runes that resembled small lightning bolts on the soldiers' gray collars. This was the mark of the SS. Some wore soft caps with the death's head patch above the brim. Others wore helmets with fabric covers that matched their smocks. Some of the SS soldiers snickered and joked at the pilot without a plane. Clad in his crumpled gray officer's cap, cracked leather flight suit, and heavy muddy boots, Franz looked haggard but tough. Some of the SS soldiers glared as Franz walked between them. Franz stared ahead and trudged along. Franz knew the soldiers on either side of him were the toughest and most ruthless in Germany. No pilot of the German Air Force, except for Göring, would ever be convicted of a war crime. The same could not be said of the SS men whom Franz walked past. With every step away from them, Franz expected to hear the crack of a rifle and to feel the punch of a bullet in his back. But none came. By some miracle, as if he were invisible, they let him live. Several miles later, the logging road merged with the main road. Stepping into the light and onto the concrete, Franz saw a green armored vehicle facing him, its gun leveled on the road. He knew he had reached the outskirts of Berchtesgaden. The vehicle wore a white American star on its hood. Franz raised his arms in surrender. The American infantrymen initially assumed Franz was an SS man posing as a pilot, for more lenient treatment, because of the direction he had come from. They had known that the SS were there the whole time. At first, the GI interrogators were rough, operating under the assumption that Franz was an SS officer. Then they realized otherwise, and passed Franz along to interrogators of the Army Air Forces. Franz would remember, "When they interrogated me, within the first minutes they knew I couldn't be SS because I showed them my logbook." The Air Force's interrogators recognized Franz immediately, having received JB-44's surrender at Salzburg Airport and that of Gallant at Tegernsee. Over the next 14 days, Franz submitted to a number of interrogations. The new interrogators immediately took his logbook, and overestimating its technological value, they never returned it. When Franz sat down for his first interrogation, he agreed to tell the American officers about the 262, but with a stipulation. "I still am a soldier, so I can only tell you so much." 24. Where bombs had fallen. The following year, March 1946, Straubing, Bavaria. The toes of Franz's flying boots dragged along the rough, upturned stones as the three German police officers hauled him through the streets. Two men carried him, their arms under his. The third man, the officer in charge, walked ahead of the others, leading them. Franz's senses returned. He caught his footing and limped on his own power. But the policemen would not let go. Behind Franz, the men at the brickworks poured out into the street, silently watching the drama. The townspeople on both sides of the street looked on Franz with hollow eyes and frowns. They remained silent. The war had made them apathetic to uniformed brutes dragging a man away. Franz knew he was in trouble when the officer in charge turned and entered the first dark alley they came to. The policeman pulled Franz into the alley and dropped him in the darkness between two buildings. Franz looked toward the street he had come from, warm with light, and knew he had been safe in the sight of the crowds. The police officers were bigger than him. Franz clenched his fists, anticipating a beating. The officers adjusted their collars the way a man might when rolling up his sleeves before a fight. Franz glanced toward the street, contemplating a run. He knew he wouldn't get far in his heavy boots. But then the policeman took a step back nonchalantly. The officer in charge reached in his pocket and pulled forth a pack of cigarettes. He offered Franz a cigarette. Franz hesitated. The man shook the packet.
"It's all right," he told him.
Franz drew a cigarette. One of the other officers extended his lighter. Franz puffed the cigarette to life. It was an American brand. The other men lit up too. Everyone shook out his shoulders and seemed to relax. Franz apologized for punching the brickyard manager, explaining that the man was refusing him work because he had been a fighter pilot.
"Don't worry," the officer in charge told Franz. "We're not going to do anything about it."
The officers went on to explain what the three of them had done in the war. Franz would remember, they were all old sergeants, mostly from the Air Force. The officer in charge had led a flak battery. One of his men had been a guard on airfields. The other officer had been in the infantry. The officer in charge asked Franz about his unit and where he had fought. Franz told him. The men had all heard of JV 44, Gallant's unit. The officer in charge explained that he was from Straubing and had finagled his way to end the war at a battery there. He told Franz with a laugh, "I watched you fly." He explained that he had once seen 262s high overhead. Franz laughed and said it was possible. The officer in charge glanced at his watch and stamped out his cigarette butt in the gutter. His men did the same. With the click of his boots, the officer in charge saluted Franz, holding his salute with his hand pressed to the brim of his cap. His men did the same. The three policemen held their salutes, their eyes locked on Franz. In his threadbare coat and fingerless gloves, Franz raised his hand to his brow, clicked together the heavy heels of his flying boots with a thud, and saluted them back. The policemen wheeled and walked out of the alley. Stepping into the sun, they turned toward the brickyard to continue their patrol. Franz followed them, but turned the other direction, away from the scene of the incident. He walked back the way he had come, toward the sun and along the road where bombs had fallen. For months, Franz scraped by in Straubing, delivering what money he made to his mother and Eva. Finally, in 1947, he found work fixing sewing machines at an unlikely place, the Messerschmitt Company in Augsburg, near the former jet school at Lechfeld. No longer did the builder of 109s and 262s make fighters. After the war, they had transitioned to building knitting looms and personal sewing machines at the same factories. In 1948, Franz married Eva. They settled into their new post-war life together. As the years passed, Franz stayed in touch with some of his old comrades, including Ruddle. In winter 1953, they met at a pub halfway between their homes and went drinking for the last time. Franz told Ruddle that he was leaving soon for Canada, where he had secured the job of a lifetime, to work as an engineer on a new Canadian fighter plane. Ruddle tried to talk Franz into staying. He had heard rumors that the German Air Force was soon to be rebuilt. Officers who had served with honor in World War II would be invited back for a chance to lead. In 1949, the Allies had given West Germany her sovereignty back. They needed an ally and knew that if the Cold War turned hot, Germany would be its battlefield. To block the Red Tide from invading Europe, the Americans were preparing to train German pilots to fly American jets to shoot down Soviet bombers before they dropped their nukes on Europe. With the Allies' blessing, a group of German generals had quietly gathered in 1950 to plan the revival of the military that would be called the Federal Defense Force, or Bundeswehr. Ruddel told Franz that if he stayed, they both could join together and continue their careers in the new Air Force. They could fly alongside American and British pilots instead of against them.
Ruddle had talked to Trautloft and the Count, who were contemplating the opportunity. Ruddle said that even Steinhoff, who had survived his burns, was hoping the Allies would let him wear his uniform again. But Franz told Ruddle he was done with the notion of following orders. He had seen what following orders had done to Germany. Germany had become a land dotted with strange new hills. The hills had sprung up outside of new towns, where villagers had piled the debris that had once been their old towns before they were destroyed in the war. The last order Franz had followed was from Lieutenant Pirkan, who asked him to visit his mother and sister in Graz to convey his goodbyes. Franz had traveled to Graz immediately after the Americans released him, and would never talk about that experience. Franz told Ruddle that he wanted to build and fly airplanes. It was all he had ever wanted. Through friends at the Messerschmitt Company, Franz had secured an offer to work on the proposed Canadian fighter called the Arrow. The job was in payload, weight, and balancing, if the jet was approved for production by the Canadian government. Seeing Franz's enthusiasm, Ruddle encouraged him to take the leap and go to Canada. He warned Franz, "You'll have to learn English, you know." Franz told Ruddle he was already practicing. Franz wished Ruddle luck in trying to rejoin the Air Force. If there ever is a German Air Force again. The two parted with a silent handshake. After what they had seen together, words were inadequate. Franz found the experience of leaving his homeland easier than he had thought it would be. In Germany, the ghosts of the war were close to home. Whenever a plane flew overhead, Franz thought of his young pilots. He saw the suffering in the eyes of his countrymen. He also remembered how some of them had turned on him. In the forests and camps of Germany, Franz saw the ghosts of the Holocaust, the crimes of the minority that had spoiled every German fighting man's honor. One German fighter pilot spoke for the fighter forces when he wrote, "The atrocities committed under the sign of the swastika deserve the most severe punishment. The Allies ought to leave the criminals to the German fighting soldiers to bring to justice." Several months later, spring 1953, Canada. When Franz and Ava relocated to Canada, they settled with Ava's brother, who had moved to Vancouver on the west coast to work in the lumber industry. There, Franz waited to be called to work on the Arrow. When the Canadian government approved the Arrow for production that July, the military classified the jet as top secret. Franz lost his job before it began. When he applied for a security clearance, he was refused because he had been a German officer. Franz took the setback in stride. His brother-in-law helped him find a job at a logging camp in the Queen Charlotte Islands. There, Franz worked as a diesel mechanic, fixing logging trucks. He lived in the company of 27 lumberjacks and their families. He quickly learned English and liked working with his hands and amid nature. He and Ava had a daughter named Jovita, but the couple's relationship was not to last. Some would say that a good relationship requires a sun and a moon, and Franz and Ava were both suns, strong and stubborn. Their divorce, when it came in 1954, was amicable. Because the job paid well, Franz stayed on at the lumber camp after Ava had departed. The distant sight of the Canadian Rockies and their snowy peaks reminded him of the Bavarian Alps and the life he had once loved. He began to write home at night, to his mother, the men he had served with, and the people he had known. On a whim, he wrote to Mr. Greisse, the kindly bureaucrat who had supervised pensions, whose address he had saved. But Mr. Greisse did not write back. Instead, his daughter Hia did. She told Franz that her father was ill. Because he had been a member of the party, the Soviets had locked him up in a camp at the war's end. An average-sized man before the war, he came back to his daughter 5 years later, weighing just 90 pounds. Hia had been a short 13-year-old kid with strawberry blonde hair when she and Franz first met. Now she was 23 and eager to explore the world. She asked Franz questions about Canada. Franz wrote back. Despite the 15-year age gap between them, the two began to correspond. Hia told Franz about her experiences after the war's end, how she traded her mother's china for food from local farmers. She wrote about the Soviet soldiers who had moved into her house, washing their potatoes in the toilets, shattering her mother's crystal glasses, and getting drunk every night while singing Lily Marlene.
They were mostly nice, but boy, if they got drunk, you didn't want to be around them as a girl,
she told Franz. Hia confided that the Soviets had raped most of the women in and around Berlin in the year after the war. She would not talk about what happened to her sister. For the better part of 2 years, Franz and Hia corresponded weekly. Every so often, Franz called her from the only phone on the island, one located in the office of the lumberyard. In 1956, Hia boarded a plane and traveled to Vancouver, where she and Franz met for the first time in 12 years. Her blonde hair curled above her ears, and her posture was impeccable. She wore a sky-blue skirt and blouse with white buttons that led up to a high collar and tiny black gloves. Franz had come to know Haya's beautiful personality, but he never guessed that the short little girl would one day grow up to be so gorgeous. Their plan had been an unspoken one. Within a year of meeting, they headed to the city hall in Vancouver and were married. Hia enjoyed moving with Franz to his island in the Queen Charlotte's, where they shared a small cabin. On their first night together on the island, Franz led Hia outside to look at the sky just as they had during the war. He held her hand as he showed her the aurora borealis, the colorful northern lights. But when Hia saw the lights flickering on the horizon, she cried hysterically. The northern lights had triggered flashbacks in her mind, memories of Potsdam and Berlin burning. With time, she came to appreciate the lights, but she never saw the same beauty in them that Franz did. Franz's mother came to visit him and Hia, even though she was not thrilled about the idea of them having married in City Hall instead of a church. She stayed for 4 months. When Franz would tell old fighter pilot jokes during their dinners together, his mother would always chide him, "Franz, your lucky dad is not around." Franz's mother asked him to go to church with her and to attend confession. He did, and confessed to a priest that he had not attended church for 20 years because he had been caught dueling. The priest laughed, welcomed Franz back, and said, "In that case, you're overdue for communion." Franz and Hia tried to convince Franz's mother to stay with them longer, but she refused. She missed her friends. But more than anything, she missed her beer. Hia and Franz seldom discussed the war. Hia discovered a story from Franz's past one night by accident. In the logging camp, the families often threw parties. After one party, Franz had too many drinks. As Hia steered them on the path to their cabin, they came across a mother bear in the moonlight. She was leaning over a fence, grunting, calling her cub that was stuck on the other side. But in his drunken state, Franz forgot where he was.
"It's my bear,"
he told Hia, but she did not understand.
"I have to say hi to him,"
Franz pleaded. Hia whispered that it was a bad idea. She held Franz back, but Franz insisted that it was his bear and struggled. Hia knew he was going to get himself mauled. When Hia could no longer hold Franz back, she kneed him in the rear. As he was distracted by his hurting backside, Hia pulled him home and put him to bed. The next morning, as Hia served breakfast, Franz ate standing. He told her,
"I must have hurt myself last night. I don't know how, but I can't sit."
From her seat at the table, Hia explained why he was so sore. Franz slowly took a seat across from her, wincing. Then he told her the war story of a lovable bear. 25. Was it worth it? 24 years later, 1980, Vancouver. The arrival of the '80s found Franz and Hia happily enjoying their retirement years, exploring the mountains of Vancouver and fishing from its lakes. Time had shrunken Franz's stature. Now 65, he had grown shorter and thicker. His neck seemed to shrink into his shoulders, but his face remained strong. As his cheeks sagged, they gave a sterner impression when he was not smiling. He still dressed like every day was a day in the office, wearing dress slacks, a long-sleeved shirt, and a fleece vest over top, the look of a Silicon Valley entrepreneur well before its time. Hia cut her hair short, but retained her youthful charm, her sassy German spirit only growing. Together, they had bought a ranch and raised a Shetland pony in a barn behind their home. Franz smoked like a chimney, until one morning he felt winded after walking to feed the pony. That afternoon, he told Hia, "I don't smoke anymore."
"Since when?" she asked.
"Since this morning," he told her. In a moment, Franz kicked a nearly 40-year habit. For fun, Franz took to flying sport planes and even purchased a Messerschmitt 108, a 4-seat personal transport plane with elegant lines just like his old 109s. He even painted the 108 like his wartime 109 and flew it at air shows as the bad guy that P-51s would chase around the sky to the crowd's delight. One day, Franz's old commander, Gallant, came to visit him. When Gallant arrived at Franz's doorstep, he was a smaller, gentler version of his larger-than-life self in World War II. His trademark mustache was gray, and he still wore his hair slicked back, only now it was gray at the temples. Gallant's black eyes pierced from heavier eyelids. His smirk was unchanged. After the war, he had found work as a forestry agent, maintaining game lands, hunting, and reflecting on the war. Then German aircraft designer Kurt Tank invited Gallant to join him in Argentina, where he was building a fighter jet for Juan Perón, the country's dictator. Perón needed someone to train his pilots and build his air force, so Tank recruited Gallant. After that stint, Gallant had returned to Germany and flown an air race with Edu Neumann and in air shows. He had consulted on the movie Battle of Britain and ran the Association of German Fighter Pilots. He had married 3 times, raised a family, and often vacationed with his former British enemies, fighter pilots Robert Stanford Tuck and Douglas Bader. Gallant wanted to go hunting with Franz, so Franz borrowed a beaver float plane from a doctor friend. He flew Gallant to a lodge on a river in northern Canada. When Franz taxied the float plane to shore, he approached too fast and beached the craft on the sand. Gallant gave him heck for the bad landing. Franz laughed him off, telling Gallant, "You always have to be the general, eh?" Franz was not one for hunting, but accompanied Gallant, who shot a moose. They gave its meat to a local Native American tribe, then hauled the moose's head back to Vancouver, where Franz shipped the horns to Germany for Gallant. In the days that followed, Franz and Gallant talked once a week by phone. 5 years later, 1985. Franz looked at the party invitation in his hands with disbelief. The Boeing company had learned of Franz through his airshow flying and invited him to attend their 50th anniversary party for the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. Franz pondered the invitation, unsure if he should attend. He began thinking about the war again. A memory resurfaced, one long locked away. In his mind, he saw the battered bomber he had let escape. He told the story to Hia for the first time. The question began troubling him again, like an unhealed wound. Did the B-17 make it home to England? He knew the only people he could ask would be the plane's crew, but the odds were slim that they had made it across the sea, let alone survived the war. Of the 12,000 B-17s built, 5,000 had been destroyed in combat. Even slimmer was the prospect that if the crew had survived, they would still be alive 41 years later, or even possible to locate. Franz had no names to reference, no tail number, just a memory. But Franz knew he had taken a great risk in helping the bomber escape, and he longed to know, was it worth it?
"You should go to the party and ask around," Hia advised Franz. "It may be your last chance."
Despite his hesitation, Franz traveled to the Museum of Flight at Payne Field to attend Boeing's party. Once again, Franz found himself a lone German traveling through a swarm of Americans. Some 5,000 former B-17 pilots and crewmen had attended. Franz nervously wandered around the three B-17s that had been flown in for the veterans to tour. He expected his old enemies to hate him. Instead, the old B-17 veterans, who now wore thick glasses with big frames, crowded around him and bombarded him with questions.
"How did you have time to aim when attacking us?"
one asked.
"You only had a fraction of time. Then you had to go right through,"
Franz explained.
"Yes, he used to go right through us,"
another B-17 vet chimed in, to which Franz laughed.
"Yeah, more or less."
Franz asked every veteran he met if the man knew of a bomber that had been escorted to safety by a German fighter. None had heard of such a thing. Colonel Robert Morgan, the former captain of the famed B-17 Memphis Belle, was there, and Franz asked him. Morgan had heard of no such thing, but the notion gave him a chuckle. A camera crew from the local King 5 TV station was filming the party and interviewing veterans for a TV special. They filmed Franz, who described the B-17 he was looking for, the most badly damaged B-17 he had witnessed.
"I've seen a B-17 flying without the rudder,"
Franz said in their TV program.
"I saw him flying with half the tail shot off, and still flying."
Franz did not know the name Ye Old Pub, or the name of its pilot, Charlie Brown, and he had long forgotten the date, December 20th, 1943, but he knew what he had seen.
"We knew we had a job to do, defend our country,"
Franz said in the program, "and we knew the boys in those airplanes had a job to do, too, because they had orders to get the war finished, and it was just such fierce combat." Franz left Boeing's party with new friends among former adversaries and an invitation from the American Fighter Aces Veterans Association to attend future reunions as their guest. Franz returned to Vancouver certain that he would never know the B-17 crew's fate. At the opposite corner of the continent, in Miami, Florida, Charlie Brown was pondering his half of the December 20th encounter. Charlie's life after World War II had been idyllic. During college in West Virginia, he had met a girl named Jackie, a petite brunette who always wore her hair in a neat bun. She was from a small West Virginia town like Charlie's and captivated him with her colorful dresses and classiness. Jackie understood what Charlie had endured during the war. She was a young war widow whose first husband had been a fighter pilot killed over Europe. Charlie and Jackie hit it off and married in 1949. That same year, Charlie returned to the Air Force and made a career in military intelligence, and even served in London as an attaché to the RAF. During this time, he and Jackie had two children, daughters Carol and Kimberly. In 1965, Charlie retired early, as a lieutenant colonel, to work for the State Department in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. There, for 6 years, he supervised the flow of food and aid to America's regional allies. When Charlie retired for good in the early 70s, he moved to Florida, bought a house, and drove a big Cadillac with Air Force wings on its license plate. Charlie seemed to grow taller and lankier with age, and lost only a few inches of his hairline. He wore yellow-tinted glasses, high-waisted pants, and long shirts with their sleeves always rolled up. He was never without a bolo tie. He drank a martini each night and always carried a first aid kit of gin, vermouth, two glasses, and a shaker in the trunk of his car. As a hobby, Charlie pursued his passion for science and invention and worked with other inventors to develop environmentally friendly diesel engines long before such research was popular. He spent hours on the golf course, volunteered at his church, and doted on Jackie, who still wore her colorful dresses and makeup every day. She was calm, dignified, and a great cook. Charlie's daughters lived nearby and often came for dinner. He knew he had a wonderful life. In these, his golden years, Charlie's war memories resurfaced. He had attended a bomb group reunion in 1957, but nothing more. Back then, the memories were too fresh and painful. Now, he began having nightmares again. He would dream about December 20th, and the dream always ended with the pub spinning to earth in a death dive from which he could not recover. Charlie always awoke just before he crashed in the dream. Standing in his bathroom looking in the mirror, Charlie tried to tell himself that December 20th was long over. But something deep within him was eating at his subconscious, and he knew it was not just the spin. He needed closure. Charlie joined the 379th Bomb Group Association, as well as the Association for his pilot class, to reconnect with his old buddies. At the 1985 Las Vegas reunion of his pilot class, Charlie and his classmates sat in a circle in the hotel's hospitality suite, swapping war stories. One of the men in the circle was Charlie's former classmate, Colonel Joe Jackson. Jackson had a round, friendly face and still wore his hair in a military crew cut. He told his war stories with an upbeat Georgian accent. Jackson had been a bomber pilot in World War II and a fighter pilot in Korea. In Vietnam, he had flown transport planes, and his actions had earned him the Medal of Honor. Jackson did not tell that story, but Charlie and the others had heard what he had done. Jackson had landed a transport on an airfield that was being overrun by the enemy. Miraculously, he had rescued three Air Force combat controllers, picking them up and whisking them away. His plane came back with countless holes and even an unexploded rocket-propelled grenade in the nose. Charlie stunned his scotch-sipping buddies when he casually remarked, "You'll never believe this, but one time I was saluted by a German pilot." Jackson and the others were so intrigued that they prompted Charlie to reveal the full story. Charlie told them of the German pilot who had spared him and his crew.
"You should look for him," Jackson urged Charlie. "He might still be out there."
Charlie knew the odds were slim. The German fighter pilots had been all but wiped out. How could he find an unknown enemy pilot he had flown with for 10 minutes, neither having exchanged a single word? It was 42 years later. But still he wondered, who was he, and why did he let us go? Charlie began his search for the German pilot. In his free time during the next 4 years, Charlie used his Air Force connections to cull the archives in America and England and discovered his crew's after-action report from December 20th. It had been stamped classified, but contained nothing sensitive. Charlie recalled the man who had written the report, Seething's lanky intelligence officer, Lieutenant Robert Harper. So, Charlie contacted the 448th Bomb Group Association and discovered that Harper resided in New England. Charlie called Harper, who remembered him instantly. Harper told Charlie that he had stayed on for another tour in England, then become an architect after the war. Having retired, Harper told Charlie his new hobby was painting. That gave Charlie an idea.
"Do you think you could paint a portrait of our plane?" Charlie asked him.
Harper remembered the pub and agreed.
"This time, is it safe to include the German?" Charlie joked.
Harper laughed and agreed to paint the 109 flying alongside the pub, his way of making amends for having quashed the story during the war. Harper painted the scene in watercolors, then hit a roadblock. He called Charlie. He did not know what markings to paint on the German plane. Charlie had no idea either.
"Let's leave that part blank," Charlie told Harper, "just in case I find him."
Charlie had read in an aviation magazine that Germany's most famous pilot, General Adolf Galland, had recently made an amazing reunion of his own. Galland had reunited with his wartime crew chief, Gerhard Meyer, by placing an ad in a newsletter called Jägerblatt. Jägerblatt, fighter journal, was the official publication of the Association of German Fighter Pilots, the reunion group for past and current pilots. So Charlie wrote to the editor of Jägerblatt and asked if the editor would publish his short letter describing the December 20th incident and the German pilot he was trying to find. But the editor was not eager to help a former bomber pilot. He declined Charlie's request. So Charlie tried another route and wrote to Galland to ask for his help. Galland replied by letter that he had never heard of a 109 sparing a B-17, but he would order Jaegerblatt's editor to publish Charlie's note. Gallant could do this because he had once served as the organization's president. He told Charlie to resubmit his letter, and Charlie eagerly complied. In his letter, Charlie outlined the time, place, and general details of the encounter, in which a single BF-109 made a non-firing gun camera run on the B-17 and ended up flying formation on the right wing. Charlie listed his address in Florida, where he could be reached, but Charlie did not mention that his bomber's left horizontal stabilizer had been blown away, or that his rudder was nearly gone, or that his tail gunner had been killed. His years in military intelligence had bred a sense of skepticism. He saved those details, and one last fact, as a secret test in the event that a German pilot actually came forward. Several months later, January 1990, Vancouver. At his mailbox, Franz saw that his Jaegerblatt had finally come from Germany. He plodded slowly along his driveway. Inside his house, with its walls filled with wood carvings, cuckoo clocks, and paintings of mountains, Franz dropped into his easy chair. He perused his Jaegerblatt, expecting to discover who had died since the previous issue. Then he saw it.
"Hia!"
Franz shouted. Hia came running. She assumed something bad had happened. Maybe Gallant had died.
"Here, look! This was him!"
Franz shouted. Hia looked confused.
"The one I didn't shoot down!"
Franz clarified. Over Franz's shoulder, Hia read the newsletter, amazed. As Gallant had promised, Jaegerblatt had published Charlie's looking-for letter. Like a small ad, it occupied a quarter of a black-and-white page. Franz stood up and shuffled to his den, with its wallpaper that resembled old newspaper print. He opened the cover on his typewriter, slipped a piece of paper within the rollers, and quickly pounded out a letter that read, January 18th, 1990. "Dear Charles, all these years I wondered what happened to the B-17. Did she make it or not? As I am a guest of the American fighter aces, I inquired time and again, but without any results. I have been a guest at the 50th anniversary of the B-17, and I could still not find any answers, whether it was worth to risk a court-martial. I am happy now that you made it, and that it was worth it. I will be in Florida sometime in June, as guest of the American fighter aces, and it sure would be nice to talk about our encounter. By the way, after I landed at Bremen Airport, I borrowed the Fieseler Stork from the airport commander to fly out to a B-17, which I shot down. The field I landed in just was not cooperating, and I stood on my head or prop. I just wanted to be sure that the crew was treated correctly. My landing was not appreciated, I told in the officer's mess, as I was forced to stay overnight to have one of my radiators changed, which had a 50-caliber bullet stuck in it. For now, horrido. Yours, signed, Franz. Franz Stiegler." 5 days later in Miami, Jackie brought Charlie his mail as he sat at his desk, listening to the radio. He sliced the letter with an opener.
"My God!"
Charlie muttered as he read the letter in disbelief. He called his wife.
"Could it be him?"
Jackie asked. Thinking like an intelligence officer, Charlie pointed out that Franz had asked for nothing. He had not listed his phone number or said they needed to write a book together and tell the world of their encounter. He simply had suggested that maybe they could meet someday and that he was happy Charlie had made it.
"I've got a good feeling this is the guy," Charlie told his wife. "But I'm not getting my hopes up yet."
Charlie sat down to type a letter back to Franz. Midway through the process, he became impatient and stopped.
"The heck with it," he said.
Picking up the phone, Charlie dialed information. He asked for the Vancouver phone directory and if there was a Franz Stiegler listed. The operator told him there was and gave him Franz's number. Charlie called, and Franz picked up. Is this Mr. Franz Stiegler? Charlie asked.
Yeah, Franz replied. This is he.
The Franz Stiegler who flew in World War II? Charlie asked.
Yeah,
Franz replied, sounding confused.
Franz, I think we go way back. This is Charlie Brown.
The conversation was strange and awkward at first. Charlie asked Franz a series of questions to figure out if he was really the one. Franz described the bomber's battle damage. He mentioned the missing stabilizer. He said the rudder was nearly gone. He told Charlie the tail gunner's position was shattered. Charlie's heart skipped a beat. He had never mentioned the stabilizer, rudder, or tail gun position in his Jaegerblatt letter. But Franz knew everything. Then Franz told Charlie,
"When I let you go over the sea, I thought you'd never make it across."
"My God, it is you!"
Charlie said. Tears ran down his cheeks and onto the phone's handset. Charlie had purposely never mentioned anything in the letter about flying over the water. That was his secret test. All Charlie had mentioned was that the encounter had happened over land. Yet Franz knew they had flown together out and over the sea. His emotions flowing, Charlie asked Franz the first thing that came to mind.
"What were you pointing for? You kept pointing and trying to tell us something."
"To get you to land in Sweden,"
Franz told Charlie, choking up himself.
"I had no idea," Charlie replied. "Otherwise I would have flown there, and would still be speaking Swedish today."
The day after their conversation, Charlie wrote, "Receiving your letter was one of the greatest thrills of my life. I had to know for sure, and obtained your telephone number from the Vancouver operator. My conversation with you totally dispelled any doubt when you mentioned going over the water with us. That has never been advertised in any of the letters seeking the 109 pilot." In his letter, Charlie asked Franz about the markings on his fighter, so his friend Robert Harper could complete his painting. He also asked Franz to keep him informed if he was indeed coming to Florida to the American Fighter Aces Convention, where he hoped they could meet. Charlie closed the letter by writing, "I have the distinct feeling that some power greater than that of our respective governments was looking out for most of us on December 20th, 1943. To say thank you, thank you, thank you, on behalf of my surviving crew members and their families, appears totally inadequate. Even though we still had one functional gun left in the top turret, we were effectively out of the war. I am not only thankful that you did not bring about our demise, but also grateful you did not pull out a Walther P-38 pistol or slingshot and finish us off while you were flying close formation with our right wing. I am sure that your skill and daring made you an extremely successful fighter pilot. However, if you repeatedly exhibited that type of camaraderie, chivalry, and daring, your chance of surviving combat would not have been too great. I join you in being most grateful that you were not court-martialed for your chivalry on December 20th, 1943. With warmest regards, signed, Charlie. Charles L. Brown." Charlie wrote to Franz unaware that Franz was an ace, or where he had served. He just knew that Franz was a good man. But Charlie still needed to know why Franz had spared him. That spring, Franz suffered lung ailments and had to cancel his trip to Florida. Charlie offered to travel to Seattle instead if Franz would meet him there. Franz agreed, and the men set a date. Several weeks later, June 21, 1990, Seattle. On the day of their planned reunion, Charlie paced within the Embassy Suites Hotel, wearing one of his baggy gray suits and bolo ties. He knew Franz and Hia were due to arrive at 11:30 a.m., and that emotions would run high, so he planned a good-spirited joke. Charlie had recently received prints from Harper of his finished painting that showed Franz's 109 flying with Charlie's B-17. Harper entitled the work, "The Ultimate Honor," Harper's talents had come a long way. Charlie gave one of the prints to the lady at the front desk and asked her, "When Mr. and Mrs. Stiegler check in, can you please give this to Mr. Stiegler and ask him if he is the famous German fighter ace?" The girl agreed to play along. Charlie watched and waited from a raised balcony overlooking the hotel's atrium. At noon, Franz and Hia appeared in the lobby and approached the desk. Charlie recognized Franz from photos they had exchanged. The lady at the front desk handed Franz the print and played along. Franz looked around frantically, knowing Charlie had to be behind such a joke.
"That's enough," Charlie chuckled to himself. He took the elevator down to the lobby and stepped out.
Franz saw Charlie and ran to him. The two former enemies hugged and cried. Charlie's wife had been unable to travel with him to meet Franz, so he had brought a friend, Joe Jackson, the Medal of Honor recipient who had first suggested he look for Franz. The following morning, Jackson joined Franz and Charlie as they sat in Charlie's hotel room and talked. Jackson had brought his video camera and filmed their discussion. He knew he was watching history in the making. "It was such an incredible, once-in-a-lifetime thing," Charlie would remember. "I believed that I had a better chance of winning the lottery than finding him alive some 40 years later." Jackson's film of Charlie and Franz's reunion is now available for viewing on the author's website.
"The odds against this happening are millions to one," Charlie told the camera. "First, of either of us surviving for 46+ years, and then being able to get in contact."
Jackson interjected and asked Franz what he was feeling, having finally met Charlie. Franz struggled with his words.
"It wasn't easy,"
Franz said as he fought tears and began to sniffle.
"I hugged him."
Wiping his eyes with one hand, he slapped Charlie on the shoulder to keep from crying and said, "I love you, Charlie." Over the next 2 days, Charlie and Franz revived old memories as they toured Seattle. Franz told Charlie about his brother, the reason he became a fighter pilot. Charlie told Franz about growing up on a farm and losing his mother. Charlie learned that Franz had not been out of ammo when he flew alongside the Pub, as Charlie had assumed. Franz revealed quite the opposite. His guns had been full. Charlie also discovered that the man who spared him was not just any pilot. He was one of Germany's greatest aces, a man who had served in the squadron of experts. Charlie wanted to learn more about JB 44. Franz said many of the stories were too painful, but he promised to give Charlie a book about the unit. In parting, Charlie told both Franz and Hia,
"You'll be pleased to know that our B-17, ye old Pub, never dropped bombs on Germany again."
Back at his home in Miami, Charlie told Jackie, "It was like meeting a family member, a brother you haven't seen in 40 years.
"Did you find out why he spared you?"
she had asked. Charlie nodded.
"I was too stupid to surrender," Charlie said, "and Franz Stiegler was too much of a gentleman to destroy us."
Charlie never had his nightmares of the spin again after meeting Franz. After having met Charlie, Franz talked with Gallant by phone. Franz admitted to Gallant that he had let the B-17 escape. All Gallant had to say was,
"It would be you."
Gallant revealed that he had ordered Jägerblatt to publish Charlie's letter. Franz could sense that Gallant was neither thrilled nor angry that he had let the bomber escape. Instead, Gallant had mixed feelings, having lost his younger brothers in the war. Even 46 years later, he considered Franz's act to be dereliction of duty, and yet the right thing to do. Franz and Gallant would continue to talk week after week until Gallant's death in 1996. As news of Charlie and Franz's reunion circulated, it made the headlines. Jägerblatt ran a story about Franz's reunion with Charlie under the title, "An Act of Chivalry in the Skies Over Europe." Franz began receiving phone calls from Germany that delivered the same message.
"Is this Franz Stiegler?"
"Yeah." You pig-headed asshole!
Click. Others began,
Are you Franz Stiegler who didn't shoot the B-17 down?
Yeah. Traitor!
Click. The calls disturbed Hia until Franz told her, You have to understand that people were being killed by the B-17s, and this person who called may have lost his family to a bombing raid.
As the story of Franz and Charlie's reunion circulated in North America, Canadian and American TV stations ran the story with teasers like, Why did this Luftwaffe ace spare an American bomber crew and risk a date with Hitler's firing squad? And, A Change of Heart, a mystery that would remain unsolved for decades, a Remembrance Day story you won't soon forget. Despite being widely well-received, the stories were not appreciated by everybody. Franz received a few calls from his Canadian neighbors, who were surprised to discover that the enemy lived among them.
Is this Franz Stiegler?
Yeah. Go home, you Nazi bastard.
Click. They'll never understand, Franz would say to calm Hia.
2 months later, September 13, 1990, Massachusetts. The cameraman, producer, and sound technician with his boom microphone backpedaled as they led Charlie and Franz in a walk-around inspection of the olive-colored B-17 that sat on the sunlit tarmac. Charlie walked slowly to keep pace with Franz, who hobbled with his cane. The two talked as the camera recorded every nuance. Charlie wore a blue vinyl jacket covered with Air Force patches. A smattering of pewter pins of B-17s covered his matching blue ball cap, with an 8th Air Force patch in its center. At Charlie's side, Franz wore a navy blazer over khaki pants, free of pins or patches. But on his head, he wore a blue ball cap with a square patch that surrounded a yellow embroidered B-17 and the title, the 379th Bomb Group. Old veterans and their families milled around and through the bomber, posing for photos in the waste windows and under the open bomb bay. A reunion of the 379th Bomb Group was underway. Charlie and the veterans of the 379th Bomb Group had invited Franz to attend as their guest. They had given him the hat he wore. They would one day make him an honorary member of the 379th Bomb Group. The cameramen were filming for the CBS News This Morning show. At a time when the world was focused on a pending war in the Persian Gulf, anchor reporter Wayne Friedman had gotten wind of another big story, a human interest tale of redemption that he would later bill as the story of a war reunion that only took place because of the compassion of an enemy. Around the bomber, the 379th veterans and their families grew respectfully silent as Charlie, Franz, and the camera crew circled the plane.
"This one looks nice compared to yours,"
Franz said offhandedly to Charlie, who chuckled in agreement. Under the bomber's wing, Hia and Charlie's wife Jackie watched from the shade, having just met. After the CBS crew lowered their cameras and departed, Charlie and Franz remained with their wives, chatting. Charlie looked over his shoulder periodically, toward a shadowy hangar, as if expecting someone. Finally, two old veterans emerged from the hangar and hobbled toward the small gathering under the wing. The sight was not unusual for a reunion, two veterans with their wives, sons, and daughters behind them. But these men who approached Charlie and Franz were special. Charlie knew them, but Franz did not.
"Franz, there's two gentlemen who would like to meet you,"
Charlie said, fighting a grin. He steered Franz out from under the wing and into the light. The first veteran to reach Franz was Charlie's old ball turret gunner, Sam Blackie Blackford, whose wide mustache was gray and whose head was bald but for wispy gray hair above his ears. Blackie started crying as he shook Franz's hand vigorously, refusing to stop. The other veteran was Charlie's radio operator, Dick Peschau, whose hair had turned white and whose eyes remained meek behind tortoiseshell glasses. Charlie looped his arms over Franz and Blackie, hugging them
Blackie broke down. Through sobs, he thanked Franz for sparing his life, and said that because Franz had not pulled the trigger on him, his children and grandchildren were able to experience life. Peschau draped his arms silently around Franz and the others as the four huddled. Blackie's tears made Franz sob, and Franz's crying made Charlie well over. The veterans' families and the other old men of the 379th kept their distance at first. Then, when they could stand it no more, they converged around the sobbing veterans, who were their husbands or fathers or grandfathers or buddies. From above it must have looked funny, the circle of people crowding around one small man in the center, hugging him and one another amid sounds of tears and laughter. But everyone that day owed something to Franz Stiegler, the man in the middle. Because of him, 25 men, women, and children, the descendants of Charlie, Blackie, and Peschau, had the chance to live, not to mention the children and grandchildren of Charlie's other crewmen. But Franz thought he had been the one given a gift. When he presented Charlie a book about the squadron of experts, inside the cover he penned an inscription, quiet words that the world was never meant to hear. When Charlie read it, he could hear Franz's voice. In 1940, I lost my only brother as a night fighter. On the 20th of December, 4 days before Christmas, I had the chance to save a B-17 from her destruction, a plane so badly damaged it was a wonder that she was still flying. The pilot, Charlie Brown, is for me as precious as my brother was. Thanks, Charlie. Your brother, Franz. From above, the circle of people blended as they hugged near the bomber's wing, becoming just one mass, bigger and greater as the gaps between them vanished. Afterward. In 1955, the United States and her allies formally welcomed West Germany into NATO and revived the German Air Force. In recognition of their honorable service to their country during World War II and absence of affiliation with the party, the following officers were reinstated at their old ranks and led successful careers in the new German Air Force. Gerhard Gerd Barkhorn, retired as a 3-star general. Gustav Rudel, retired as a 1-star general. Hannes Trautluft served as the inspector general and retired as a 3-star general. Erich Hohagen retired as a 1-star general. Walter the Count Krupinski retired as a 3-star general. Erich Bubi Hartmann joined the new Air Force after 10 years in Soviet POW camps and later retired as a colonel. Johannes Maki Steinhoff joined the new Air Force and climbed the ranks in spite of his severe disfigurement from his burns. He eventually served as the Air Force's commander and retired in 1974 as a 4-star general. In 1997, the German fighter Wing 73 was given the honorary name Steinhoff, one of the few wings named after a man. Today, the Steinhoff wing flies regularly alongside the Richthofen wing, named for the Red Baron. In 1957, at a 379th Bomb Group reunion, Charlie revealed his true age to his crew. The quiet ones were surprised, but not offended. They figured Charlie had done a fine job of getting them home, the only measure that mattered. Charlie never had contact with Marjorie after the war, but last heard she had gotten married and never stopped flying. In the years following their reunion, Franz and Charlie traveled across North America telling their story to any civic clubs, air museums, or military units that requested them. This was their last act of service to build a better world. Their message was simple. Enemies are better off as friends. Franz Stiegler succumbed to illness in March 2008. Shortly before he died, Franz asked Hia to cremate his body, but to keep his ashes close. "I promise I won't be a bother," he said. After 52 years of marriage, he died in Hia's arms. Charlie Brown died in November 2008, 8 months after Franz. Prior to Charlie's death, the U.S. Air Force completed a lengthy investigation into the events of December 20, 1943, and the actions of Charlie and his crew. The Air Force ruled that military officials had made a mistake in how they had handled the case 64 years earlier. In April 2008, the Air Force summoned Charlie to the Florida State Capitol and awarded him the nation's second highest medal for valor, the Air Force Cross. The Air Force also presented Charlie's last living crewman, Albert Doc Sadock, with the Silver Star, and posthumously awarded a Silver Star to each of the 8 deceased members of the crew. Today, with a combined 9 Silver Stars and 1 Air Force Cross, the crew of Ye Olde Pub remains one of the most decorated bomber crews in history. Franz Stiegler never got the Knight's Cross, but, as he always said, he got something better. This concludes the reading of A Higher Call, an incredible true story of combat and chivalry in the war-torn skies of World War II by Adam Makos with Larry Alexander. Copyright 2012 by Adam Makos. This book was read by Robertson Dean. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Berkeley Books, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.